comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WVOR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, President Bush expresses resolve in dealing with Iraqi insurgents.
We're going to prevail because, well, one, we've got a good strategy to deal with these killers. Two, I believe by far the vast majority of Iraqis do understand the stakes.
Also, government spending is off the charts. Is the president really a fiscal conservative?
Nicotine is shown to have some health benefits, but only if you have certain health problems, and only if you don't smoke it.
And a calorie is a calorie, the latest on that late-night binge.
And backstage with the famed Kirov Ballet.
These stories and more coming up Here Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. The marathon talkathon continues on Capitol Hill. Republican senators are criticizing Democrats for blocking some of President Bush's judicial nominees. NPR's Don Gagne reports the president weighed in on the issue this morning.
The president is heading to Florida today for a pair of campaign fundraisers and a Medicare event, but he used an early morning Oval Office photo op to call for an up or down full Senate vote on four controversial nominees to the federal bench.
I will stand with them until the bitter end because they're the absolute right pick for their respective positions. And the senators who are playing politics with their nominations are acting shamefully.
The president was joined by three of those nominees, Judges Priscilla Owen, Carolyn Kuhl, and Janice Rogers Brown. Democrats point out that 98% of the president's judicial nominees have been confirmed and that those being blocked have views that are too far outside the mainstream. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
A strong cold front from Canada is moving through the northeastern U.S. today. Meteorologist Jan Jackson of the National Weather Service says it's producing some wicked winds.
We're looking for winds that are going to be generally about 30 to 40 miles per hour with some gusts, especially in the higher elevations along the peaks, up to about 60 miles per hour.
Those same winds blew through the Midwest yesterday, downing trees and power lines and knocking out electricity to hundreds of thousands of people. Italy's defense minister says Saddam Hussein loyalists and al-Qaeda terrorists are to blame for yesterday's attack in Nasiriyah that killed 27 people, most of them Italian military policemen and soldiers. NPR's Ivan Watson tells us Antonio Martino visited the site of the attack today.
Italy's defense minister said that it reminded him of the destruction left by the September 11th attacks in New York City. It's been described as the single worst day of casualties for its military since World War II. Italy has contributed troops to peacekeeping operations in Afghanistan, in the Balkans before, and yesterday's attack also marked the first losses for Italian forces, some 2,000 Italian troops in Iraq, since they contributed their troops to the U.S.-led occupation of this country.
NPR's Ivan Watson speaking to us from Baghdad. Closing arguments are underway in Virginia Beach in the trial of accused Washington-area sniper John Allad Muhammad. Meanwhile, in nearby Chesapeake, Virginia, the trial of Muhammad's alleged accomplice, 18-year-old Lee Boyd Malvo, was just getting underway. Attorneys for both sides are making their opening statements today. Stocks are lower. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 32 points to 98.16. The Nasdaq's down 10 to 1962, and the S&P is down about 3. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the nation's trade gap grew by 4% in September. The Commerce Department says the trade deficit was slightly more than $41 billion. The deficit is the difference between the amount of U.S. goods sent abroad and the amount of foreign goods coming into the United States. Janus Capital Group is reporting that fewer investors are pulling money out of its mutual funds, but the company also indicated that improper trading activity may have been more widespread than previously reported. NPR's Chris Arnold has more.
Janus was already under scrutiny by state and federal regulators and had terminated some frequent trading agreements in its domestic mutual funds. Authorities have been cracking down on such trading since it can allow certain favored investors to skim profits away from average shareholders. In an SEC filing, Janus now says it had similar arrangements in its offshore Janus World funds. The company said, though, it's premature to suggest that the trading was improper because of differences and rules for offshore funds. Janus also reported that the National Association of Securities Dealers is requesting information regarding its relationship with broker-dealers. In September, investors pulled $3.4 billion out of Janus funds, but the company reported much smaller outflows for October. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Bridgestone Corporation of Japan's Firestone unit could be facing a strike. The company's largest union, United Steelworkers of America, says it has broken off talks on a new labor contract. It represents about 6,000 workers at Firestone's 8 plants in the U.S. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
With casualties mounting in Iraq and support from the American public shrinking, President Bush spoke to reporters this morning about the need to speed up the creation of a new Baghdad government.
We want the Iraqis to be more involved in the governance of their country. And so Ambassador Bremer, with my instructions, is going back to talk to the governing council to develop a strategy. And he'll report back after he's consulted with the very people that we want to assume more responsibility.
In addition to more involvement from the Iraqi people, aides to the president say other scenarios are being explored, including a smaller Iraqi governing council and possibly establishing an interim government before a new constitution is written. Christian Science Monitor reporter Dan Murphy is in Baghdad. He joins us on the line. And Dan, from your position on the ground, how likely is it that Baghdad officials will be able to assume more responsibility?
I think it's going to be very difficult, particularly, you know, in the medium term, especially if we define that as the next, you know, 3 to 4 months, for officials to assume more responsibility for the simple reason that, well, number one, American troops are the, you know, guarantors of security here, and we are, in essence, the sovereign power. Number two, the governing council that we've appointed has a number of people who are exiles, have no domestic power bases of their own. Some of them clearly do have domestic power bases of their own, but it's very, very difficult to determine how big they are. And most of the members of the governing council have competing agendas internally, so it's very, very difficult for them to speak with one voice. And it's also difficult for probably the more popular of them to kind of get their way, because everybody can pretend that they're much more politically important than they in fact perhaps are.
I wonder as well about the fear factor, because the insurgents have been targeting the governing council and the police.
Of course, one member of the governing council was killed, and, you know, district and neighborhood area councils, there are literally dozens of these things across the country that the coalition has set up, have had a number of members assassinated over the past couple of months, judges as well. Almost anybody that's seen as, you know, quote-unquote collaborating with the coalition by the forces who are opposed to the occupation, you know, it has been fair game, and many people are afraid, and it's certainly, you know, reducing the cooperation of local folks who would like to work with the coalition because they feel that, you know, it's just not worth it. Mm.
Dan, I want your reaction to the new U.S. military offensive, yesterday's Operation Iron Hammer, parts of the city literally hammered by bombs. Do you feel there in Baghdad as if there's a shift, a turning point?
I think that there is a shift. I don't know if it's, you know, going to be a turning point. They They used a similar strategy a few days ago in Tikrit, which is in the Sunni Triangle, and it's Saddam Hussein's hometown. They did hammer parts of the city, but they hit empty buildings. The point of these attacks seemed more to flex American muscle and to try to send a message to insurgents that, you know, we can bring devastating force to bear on our enemies if we so choose. However, there's a significant risk that this strategy could backfire because talking to many Iraqis on the street today, they feel like they're being bullied, and they feel like Iraqis in general are being targeted by such muscle flexing. So it's going to remain to be seen whether this is effective or not, the early indications are that it's a little bit counterproductive.
Well, Dan, thank you.
Thank you.
Christian Science Monitor reporter Dan Murphy spoke to us from Baghdad.
Democrats are often branded by Republicans as big spenders. But in the past 2 years, under a conservative Republican president, the federal government's grown 27%, more than in any two-year period in the past 20 years. President Bush has never vetoed a single spending bill. The binge is not only because of increased defense demands and the need to fight terror. So what's going on? Joining us to discuss the issue is the president's is Robert Bixby, the executive director of the Concord Coalition, an organization that says it promotes fiscal responsibility. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks for joining us. What's discretionary spending? That's what we're talking about here, right?
Yes, discretionary spending is that part of the budget that Congress appropriates every year.
Doesn't include entitlements like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid.
That's right. Those programs are on autopilot.
Is George W. Bush, who ran as a fiscal conservative, certainly a big spender?
It certainly has turned out that way. There's been a very large increase in spending in the last couple of years. Most of that is attributable to the defense expenditures and increases in homeland security.
So, Robert, military spending in fiscal 2003 went up some 17%, but non-military discretionary spending rose 8.7%. That's a lot, right?
It is a lot. During the 90s, when we were trying to control deficits and had caps on discretionary spending, it hardly rose at all. I mean, there were a few years where it was virtually flat. Since 2000, it has been going up. Non-defense discretionary spending has been going up by 7% in 2001, 12% in 2002, and then, as you say, close to 9% in 2003. And it's expected to go up by another 9% or so in 2004.
George W. Bush campaigned saying he wouldn't raise discretionary spending over 4% in any given fiscal year. Are there political consequences, do you think, for him, that the spending is so much greater than that?
So far, there haven't been. One of the problems is that people aren't concerned about deficits right now. And if you set the standard that deficits don't matter, then it's awfully hard to get people excited about exceeding spending limits. And I think that's what's happened now.
So lowering taxes and raising spending, that's certainly kind of a perfect storm for raising the deficit, right?
Yes. I think what's happening now is that you've got revenues going down, spending going up, and nobody in Washington trying to bring that under control. That will lead to much higher deficits than are projected. You know, we've had three rounds of tax cuts. At the same time, we're engaging in a major military conflict and trying to beef up at home on homeland security and spending more on education and spending more on transportation, things that that people want and think are important. And it just doesn't make any sense to be reducing your revenues while you're increasing your expenditures. You're just building in perpetual deficits, which for the short term we can handle. But the long term, eventually you got to pay the bill.
Now, the Bush administration does say it's going to rein in these spending percentage increases in the next year and years out after that if the president is reelected. But what are the consequences of rising spending like this for average people?
What we will have is a very long-term problem We'll have deficits that are locked in for as far as the eye can see, very large deficits, which raise the cost of interest payments that the national government needs to make on its debt, just like any other creditor. What it does is slowly sap savings out of the economy so that the government is using more of our national savings to fund its own operations rather than allowing the private sector to invest and grow the economy. So it's a slow-moving problem. But you're building in a long-term structural problem that will result in higher taxes and a slower-growing economy for not us, perhaps, but for people, you know, 5-10 years down the road.
Robert Bixby, the executive director of the Concord Coalition, thanks very much for joining us, Robert.
Okay, thank you.
Israeli officials are criticizing yesterday's United Nations report on the effects of the current and proposed barrier separating Israel from the West Bank. They say the report is inaccurate and makes no mention of suicide bombers or the 3-year Palestinian uprising the wall is meant to suppress. But the report, based on information provided by the Israeli government, is the first glimpse into the blueprint for the highly secretive wall. Joining us on the line from Jerusalem is John Ward Anderson, reporter for The Washington Post. And John, what strikes you most about the UN report?
Well, it really shows exactly how extensive the impact of this wall is going to be. It talks about affecting almost 30% of the people, the Palestinians who live in the West Bank, about more than 600,000 people. And it really shows that the fence, as most people call it, is going to be very extensive.
Well, and the Israelis, as I say, dispute the UN's findings about the number of Palestinians who will be affected by the wall. They say the UN is historically hostile to Israel, and they say it's going to be far fewer Palestinians, perhaps only 14,000, that will be cut off.
I don't know where that number comes from. The city of Qalqilya alone is completely encircled by the fence, and there are 42,000 people who live there. And I've been out, I've traveled miles and miles along the fence line. There are dozens of communities that are going to be with tens of thousands of people that are going to be on the wrong side of the wall, which is to say, if you're a Palestinian, you're going to be on the west side of the wall or the Israeli side. So I don't know where they're getting this 14,000 figure from.
Right. And the others who are not, who have to cross through the wall to work, will also find themselves on the wrong side of the wall in that case.
Exactly. To work, to go to school, to visit their fields, it's going to have a tremendous impact on people on both sides.
Well, John, we've spoken to Israelis who've said they back the wall in theory because they feel they need protection from violence that comes from the other side of the wall as the wall in Gaza works to keep suicide bombers out. Is this possibly a case of a good wall gone bad?
Well, you know, there are some Palestinians who think that the wall will serve a purpose to turn down the heat on the Intifada, to lower the level of violence, and lay the groundwork for future negotiations. They believe, Israelis and some Palestinians as well, believe that if you can stop a level of violence, that you will have a better atmosphere and more productive talks. So it is possible, but, you know, the real key here is not the wall per se, it's where the wall is going. And the problem is that it's detouring deeply into the West Bank, in some cases as much as 13 miles to surround Jewish communities.
And we've spoken of this before, so what happens now?
Boy, that's the million-dollar question here. I think the real threat here is that down the line, let's say 3 years from now, 2 million Palestinians are going to be behind a wall in the West Bank, and the Israelis are going to be able to sit back in their chairs and not really have to worry about negotiating anymore because the problem is going to be behind, 400 miles of fence.
On the other hand, is there any chance that the wall will be a new negotiating tool? In other words, put down your arms, show us some sign of stopping violence, and we'll take down the wall.
Boy, it's possible. The Israelis believe that what goes up can come down. If you've ever been to the wall, you can see that it sure looks like a permanent structure on the horizon here. I guess it's possible, but I don't think any time in the near future.
Well, John, thank you.
Robin, thank you.
John Ward Anderson, reporter for The Washington Post, speaking to us from Jerusalem.
Well, just ahead, America's new neighbor, Iran. The U.S. is in Iraq and Afghanistan. We'll look at how this relationship may be affecting politics inside Iran.
And later, backstage with the Kirov Ballet.
More coming up here and now.
Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
It can be difficult these days to sort out just where U.S.-Iranian relations stand. Iran pledged $350 million to help rebuild Iraq, even as some U.S. allies dragged their feet. But the U.S. would also like the Iranians to hand over members of al-Qaeda, Tehran's allegedly holding. Well, joining us on the line to discuss Iran and his recent contacts with Iranians is Frank Wisner, former undersecretary at the State and Defense Departments. Welcome, Ambassador Wisner.
I'm delighted to be with you, Mr. Delaney.
We're delighted to have you, Ambassador. Thanks so much. Were you in a position to do so? What would you most fundamentally do from a position of power in Washington to improve relations with Iran? I think everyone can agree that having better relations with this important country is in our interest. What would you do?
Well, better relations is, of course, one way of putting it. I think I would put it differently.
Uh-huh.
I would like to see discrete exchanges blessed and understood by both sides, supported at the highest political levels, in which quietly the two sides communicate directly or indirectly their views about common needs, to understand and begin to see what each other's limits are, what the possibilities of the two positions, how they could evolve.
Last summer, I understand, you were in Stockholm meeting with members of an Iranian think tank, Ambassador Wisner. What did you learn at that encounter?
Well, the informal encounters are several. I know of ours. There have been a number of meetings, the most recent of which, as you noted, took place in Stockholm, somewhat neutral ground. The subjects, as you can imagine, were on all of our minds at that time were the situation in Iraq, the nuclear issue, which was very hot as the summer drew to the end, and those were the two principal subjects of our commentary and review.
Ambassador, in Stockholm, you learned something about the possibility of the U.S. speaking to alleged al-Qaeda prisoners in Iran?
Well, I don't want to put words in the mouth of Iranians who were not official representatives of their government. But what was clear and what I sorted out from our conversations was the following, and that is that the Iranians much disliked al-Qaeda. They had been responsible for a certain amount of violence that the Iranians had suffered themselves. The Iranians are hardly a perfect society. There are many splits inside them. There are those who could well have taken advantage to provide some harbor. Would the Iranians deal with us directly? I doubt it. My own view is that they're going to be looking for avenues of exchange on the al-Qaeda issue to reassure us that they are doing what they have to do to control al-Qaeda, returning al-Qaeda's individuals to their home countries once they pass through the Iranian judicial system. but I never felt that it was ruled out that information could not reach us, information important to us. It might come through third parties, including countries whose citizens were part of that al-Qaeda network.
Does Iran want the United States to fail, to be humiliated, to be run out of Iraq?
I don't believe that's the case. That's not my view. The Iranians assert, and I believe it's based on reality, that they don't want a chaotic Iraq. That would put an anarchical situation on their borders. It would put great stress on their own internal debate. Not that they cheer our presence in Iraq, and many Iranians may see it as a long-term threat to them, but they don't want to see anarchy. The way I look at it is, for the first time in our history, we and Iran are direct neighbors. We're neighbors with our presence in the Gulf, we're neighbors in Iraq, and we're neighbors in Afghanistan. And more than ever, at any moment, our fates are respectively intertwined.
From a vantage point of realpolitik, I want to ask your personal sense whether, for ultimately improving relationships with Iran, was it a good idea to go into Iraq or a bad idea?
Well, Iran had no love for Saddam and was glad to see the end of him. At the same time, they want fundamentally stability in Iraq, an Iraq that they can treat, they can look to, have some predictability, where they will have a neighbor who doesn't threaten them and with whom they can learn to live in some degree of regional harmony. That's their principal objective.
So maybe not all bad.
Certainly not, because we too want a stable Iraq at the end of the day. So there is ground, common ground, to be explored.
Is it wise, Ambassador, for President Bush to express support publicly, as he has done, when Iranian students go into the streets calling for greater democracy and many being actually very pro-American? Should the president call attention to that sort of thing?
I see no problem in the United States having a general attitude, and it's rather well known, of support for democracy and the rights of those who are trying to seek a different future.
Sure.
But to weigh in on a situation that the dynamics of which you are hardly certain, I have greater reservations. I am, for example, not at all certain that the student demonstrations that you saw represent the spirit of the majority of the political community in Iran. I don't know enough to make that assertion, and I don't think we understand enough about the nature of the Iranian political debate to put our foot down on one side or another. So a general attitude of support is one thing, but getting involved in an internal political tangle that we don't understand well is another.
Frank Wisner, former undersecretary at both the State and Defense Departments. Ambassador Wisner, thank you very much for joining us on Here and Now.
Mr. Delaney, thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll revisit the case of John Hinckley. Should the man who tried to kill President Reagan go free?
And we review the new Russell Crowe film, The Seafaring Spectacular, Master and Commander. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, nicotine is found to have some positive effects on people with brain disorders.
And a new study says eating late at night isn't what makes you fat, it's what you eat.
When people eat at night, they tend to overeat. They eat more calorie-dense foods, you know, junk foods, sweets, things filled with fat, and they tend to overeat them.
Who does that? And backstage with the storied Kirov Ballet of Russia as it passes through the U.S.
These stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Steve Brown. The insurgent fighters opposing the U.S. military coalition number no more than 5,000. That's according to General John Abazid at the U.S. Central Command in Florida. Abazid says the most dangerous and largest portion of insurgents consists of fighters loyal to ousted leader Saddam Hussein. And the general says that despite the relatively low numbers, the insurgent forces have considerable training, supplies, and funding. Meanwhile, in Iraq, the U.S. is taking steps to increase security around coalition headquarters. Lourdes Navarro reports.
The 14th of July bridge was reopened to traffic in a ceremony 2 weeks ago. At the time, military commanders said they had taken the decision as a result of the improved security situation in the capital. In a sign of the changing times here, a military spokesman has announced that it will now be closed again to traffic. The bridge is near the Green Zone, where the coalition is headquartered.
A marathon debate continues in the U.S. Senate. Republicans called for the 30-hour session as a way to protest the blocking of some of President Bush's judicial nominees. President Bush says Democrats are treating his judicial nominees unfairly.
Here are three cases where people are being treated unfairly. My question is, why won't they give these three ladies an up or down vote? Where's the justice? Well, these are eminently qualified people.
Senate Democratic leader Tom Daschle disagrees.
The president ought to be very pleased with 98% of the confirmations that he's already gotten. The score is 168-4. Those are pretty good odds.
Daschle says the debate is taking much-needed time away from more important issues like health care and job creation. The session is scheduled to end at midnight. A judicial panel has ordered that suspended Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore be removed from his position. This after he defied a federal court order to remove his Ten Commandments monument from a courthouse. The panel also says Moore placed himself, quote, above the law. Moore didn't show much reaction as the panel read its decision. A federal judge in Washington says it appears convicted spy Jonathan Pollard will not be set free anytime soon. Judge Thomas Hogan today rejected Pollard's latest attempt to fight his life sentence for selling military secrets to Israel. The ruling means Pollard will stay in a federal prison and his lawyers will not get access to sensitive government documents. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are down. The Dow is down 28 points at 98.21. The Nasdaq is down 10 points at 19.63. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
For years, we've been warned away from nicotine, the highly addictive compound found in tobacco. But now researchers are saying that while nicotine has no good effects for healthy people, it may be therapeutic for those with brain disorders. The research is being funded by pharmaceutical companies, federal grants, tobacco companies, and in Vermont, in part, by the National Institute on Aging. Joining us on the line is Dr. Paul Newhouse. He's director of the University of Vermont's Clinical Neuroscience Research Unit. And, doctor, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And for those who are smokers who have just sat upright, are you saying that nicotine in all forms may actually be good for us?
No. Cigarette smoke has over 2,000 compounds in it, and nicotine is only one. Mm-hmm. Nicotine, though, is probably the only one that actually works in the brain of all the stuff that's in cigarettes. The rest of it is what's poisoning people.
Well, tell us, though, about these good effects. What kind of brain disorders are you finding that nicotine impacts?
Well, we've been interested for many years on the potential effects of nicotine on learning and memory and attention. And we're now launching a multi-center study to examine whether treating patients with mild memory loss that might be a precursor to Alzheimer's disease would be successfully helped with nicotine. Mm-hmm. So we're starting that study with a grant from the National Institute on Aging. We've also been interested in whether nicotine and nicotinic stimulation might be something that helps even, for example, children with attention deficit disorder. There has been some work done previously in this area. In fact, some of it was done in Boston. But we think we've stumbled onto perhaps what nicotine might precisely do to cognitive function, memory functioning in attention deficit disorder. And so that's another avenue of research in this area.
What happens in that case? I know you test them with, let's say, a dose given through a patch. What can you compare it to?
You get a robust improvement in the kind of attentional problems or inhibitional problems that these kids have, and that's as robust or more robust than the effects of their dose of Ritalin.
Hmm. So why aren't we immediately switching from Ritalin to nicotine?
Well, because our study is just a study of one single dose. We don't know if this works chronically. We don't know if the effects are robust over the long term. And when you start advocating treatment strategies, you have to really prove that it's safe and effective over the long haul. Mm. And we're a long way from that.
We've read that this dose of nicotine might also help people with schizophrenia, dementia, and underactive thyroid. And this might be why some people smoke. Can you explain that?
Well, we think that, for example, let's take ADHD. About half of 40 to 50% of these kids begin smoking by the time they're out of their teens. Now, certainly, this may not be the only reason they start smoking, but one of the potential reasons is that nicotine may actually be helping partially their attentional problems. And it may well explain part of the reason that smoking is so common, for example, in schizophrenia, is that nicotine is providing some cognitive benefit. It's not the only reason they could be smoking, but it may be a part of the explanation. For instance, we know that 80 to 90% of all schizophrenics smoke. Hmm. There's got to be a reason for that.
Doctor, tell me, is this potentially a case of something that's had a bad rap and a bad effect because of the way it was delivered that might turn out to be a good thing for society?
I think that's the take-home message, which is that it is possible to take something that has been used socially for hundreds and hundreds of years and discover what is the brain active ingredient in it and begin to exploit that for therapeutic use. Mm.
Doctor, thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Paul Newhouse, director of the University of Vermont's Clinical Neuroscience Research Unit.
Everyone thinks they know what they want. Sometimes your drug chooses you. There are some things that I've promised myself. Things I haven't done yet. It's my last cigarette.
No matter what time of day you choose to eat, a calorie is a calorie is a calorie. But you don't put on more weight if you eat late at night, as the urban myth goes. That's according to researchers at the Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, who made the discovery while working with monkeys. Ellen Ruppelschell is author of the book The Hungry Gene, The Science of Fat and the Future of Thin. She joins us now. Hi, Helen.
Hi, how are you?
Alan, there was a myth out there that if you eat something late at night, it makes you fatter than if you eat something in the middle of the day, right?
Yes, this is something that's commonly held by people, although scientists have never found any evidence of this.
But scientists have never been able to prove that it wasn't the case either, right, until now?
Well, it's a very difficult study to run, and in fact, this was a study done on monkeys looking at another question.
And how did they come to a conclusion then?
What this suggests is that no matter when these particular primates ate, they put on weight or took off weight at the same rate.
Now, the study was originally supposed to find out about the relationship between female hormones and weight gain, right?
Right, because what we do know is that when you have reduced levels of progesterone and estrogen, say after menopause, women tend to put on weight, and that was the original reason for this study.
Yeah. What's the importance of this, do you think, for people who are wrestling with their weight?
I think it reiterates once again what you said at the beginning of the show, which is that, in fact, a calorie is a calorie. What we know is that when people eat at night, they tend to overeat. They eat more calorie-dense foods, you know, junk foods, sweets, things filled with fat, and they tend to overeat them. And that is the reason we think that people who eat at night put on weight. It's the quantity of the food they eat. It's very rare for people to overeat at breakfast.
Now, are we talking about, was the myth about eating right before you go to bed or dinner?
There was an idea that if you ate a meal and then were sedentary, which we often are, for example, if you eat at 10 o'clock at night in front of the television, that just the very fact that you were eating before you were resting or while you were resting would cause weight gain. But in fact, there's never been any evidence of that. That's purely speculation. And this study gives more credence to the idea that whenever you eat, it really is how much you eat and what you are eating rather than when you're eating it.
Is this another of those cases of common sense crashing right into big-time science?
I'm afraid it is. This is weight loss and dieting are an area that is just rife with myth and folklore, and everybody has their own ideas. Oftentimes, science has very little to do with it.
Another myth about how to lose or gain weight down the drain. Ellen Ruppelschell, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ellen Ruppelschell is author of the book, The Hungry Gene, The Science of Fat and the Future of Thin.
Still to come, behind the scenes with the Kirov Ballet, touring the world with 200-plus people, truckloads of costumes, we wondered, how does one travel with tutus?
If you'll see, they come out, they turn them inside out and fold them in half and stack them in the box. I call them tutu tacos.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Our interview with Democratic Senator Zell Miller of Georgia, who says he's disgusted with his own party and will be backing George Bush in 2004, moved Don Henney of North Stonington, Connecticut to write, "I chuckled when I heard Senator Miller target high congressional salaries as contributing to our exploding federal deficit. You missed the opportunity to ask the senator how he declined or donated his pay raises, benefits, or retirement annuity to a more worthy cause."
Our interview with the founder of the No One Dies Alone program, created by a nurse for dying hospital patients who have no family, drew this response from Jackie Orant Nathan of Andover, Massachusetts. "As a hospice nurse practitioner, I applaud Sandra Clark for her efforts. In the absence of such a program, however, a hospice team can be utilized to comfort the patient. Most people are unaware that hospice services are available to provide comfort at the bedside, sometimes just by holding the hand of the dying."
Recently, our editorial roundtable discussed the pardon of Massachusetts daycare worker Gerald Tukey Amaralt, convicted of child molestation in 1986. One panelist was Wall Street Journal editor Dorothy Rabinowitz, a longtime defender of Amaralt, and that prompted a call from Eli Neuberger, a Boston Children's Hospital pediatrician, who testified for the prosecution at Amaralt's trial.
Well, you predicted that you would hear from doctors involved with the Emerald case, and here's one. I not only believe that the kids were innocent and they're not being biased by the interviewers, although some of the interviewing technique was atrocious, especially the ones which were taped, which is what Dorothy Rabinowitz was talking about. But more importantly, that Dorothy Rabinowitz herself was dissembling, disingenuous, biased, and extremely aggressive in her work against the victims. And I personally think that she is a dishonest and disreputable character herself, and that this is no cause for celebration.
Our segment on Democratic candidate Howard Dean deciding to forego public financing prompted this comment from Doug Wright of Wellesley, Massachusetts. I think it's important to note that taxpayers who check the box on their return are not donating to a fund for candidates. They're designating a portion of their tax, which they already have to pay, for a publicly funded campaign. I'd like to have that kind of discretion for war funding.
And finally, Matt Boris of Somerville, Massachusetts, wanted to know who performed the version of Cabaret heard at the end of our piece on the Deep Dish Cabaret in New York City. Well, it was me first and the Gimme Gimmes.
I knew that. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and the town where you live.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Monsters, fairies, a firebird, harem girls, and more than two centuries of dance history. The famed Kirov Ballet of St. Petersburg, Russia, has been carrying plenty of historic and actual baggage as the troupe tours the world. They're in Boston this week, bringing three classic Russian ballets to the stage. Chopiniana, a plotless dance of fairies dressed in flowing white. Scheherazade, the story of the Arabian Nights. And the magical firebird about, well, the mythical firebird. But magic on the stage is one thing. The hard work of unseen hundreds is quite another. Here Now's Lynn Menegon went backstage as the Kirov rolled into Boston and found that magic begins in the dressing room.
Simone Scores is going to be in this room right here for sure.
They're looking for how many rooms there are, how many people will fit in them.
Something for women. Probably split them up.
My name is Karen Clem, and my title is wardrobe supervisor. And then they'll decide which principals have their own rooms, who shares. They have the principals, the soloists, and then the corps de ballet.
So this gets into company politics?
Yes.
Definitely. So this is a very tricky issue.
Yes.
Now, has there ever been a situation, I guess you could say the myth or the legend of the Russian prima ballerina, very tempestuous, temperamental perhaps?
Not that I have noticed. Everybody that I've met has been really wonderful.
So no one's saying, these roses are not red enough, or I want my champagne?
No, not at all.
Well, that's disappointing.
The rooms are not warm enough is mostly what I heard.
Take it upstage, please, on that pile.
I've been told we're traveling somewhere around 220 people.
Does that include dancers?
Yeah. My name is Pat Thomas. I'm the production stage manager for the Kirov. We've got two masseuses. We have a whole bunch of ballet masters. Often these soloists and principals have their own teacher. They have pianists, everything.
What exactly is going on right now? It's pretty early on Wednesday morning.
What's happening is everybody is sort of broken down into departments, and each department is getting their stuff together. And as it comes off the truck, the carpenters are grabbing their things. The prop guys are grabbing their things. Our lighting supervisor sends a lighting plot ahead of time, and they get everything specced out. So they're now plugging things in and making sure that everything turns on, because it's a whole bunch of cable and there's a lot of things that can go wrong. Scheherazade has some slightly tricky hanging of scenery, because they have these really beautiful silk drops that sort of swag across the top of the stage. So it's really almost a piece of art. Firebird is fairly straightforward. Chopiniana is very straightforward. It's just a backdrop. Firebird, there's the tree.
And, looking at it on the floor here, it looks pretty unremarkable. I bet on stage it looks grand. It's just a bunch of chicken wire and some, paper leaves and some gold framing, gold-painted framing.
And then we add the good stuff. And it'll just be beautiful. You won't be able to even know it was the same thing. Yo.
So your production office is the first room?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm going to tell Gratchev and see
what he decides. Yeah, and then on top of that, we can set up quick change booths, so they don't have to worry that these will have to... Yeah, Karen says there's 10 guys in Firebird.
You're right.
So.
You're right.
What's a quick change booth, and what does it solve?
At some point in Firebird, there's all these guys on stage running all over the place, and then within the space of about 2 minutes, they all have to get changed.
Actually, 2 minutes is a long time for a quick change. They get out of costumes, and they get into, I call it Fantasia dresses. They're a two-tiered, look like a dress over pants. We have six people there. We strip them out of it. Put the other one on, button it up, and off they go.
Please, possible to steam costumes, please begin with the white ones.
Okay.
With these ones.
I think we all speak theater, and that's what I've been asked before, do you really understand Russian? And I said no, but I speak wardrobe. And so in that, it's a universal language.
How do you pack a tutu?
If you'll see, they come out, they turn them inside out and fold them in half and stack them in the box.
So you can actually fold a tutu in half?
Well, this is the only time I've seen it folded is I worked two tours with the Bolshoi, and this is my first one with the Kirov, and they're the only ones that I've seen just fold them in half like that. I call them tutu tacos.
What happens with toe shoes?
They take care of the toe shoes themselves. They each have a bag of shoes.
The dancers take care of their own?
They take care of their own shoes.
And why is that?
They prep them themselves. Some of them take a hammer and break down the wooden box that's inside. Some of them wet them. They do whatever it takes to get them comfortable for them. And it would be impossible for somebody else to do it.
What's the worst wardrobe accident that has happened on this tour so far? I think the worst thing that happened is with the extras. We have costumes that are built for dancers, and I had six pretty big guys to try to fit, so I had to put patches in the back, just strips of fabric about 6 to 10 inches wide to make the costumes fit.
Squeeze those guys into them.
You got to squeeze them in. The show must go on.
Charlie, upstage that leg now.
It's okay.
Я не про это.
The one that's hanging.
Я про зеленые кулисы, про зеленые.
Okay, today is all about steaming, a little bit of ironing. They're going to bring us racks. We're going to steam them up and prep them like any other show.
All right.
Do we have steamers available?
No. You have to have your own steamer.
There was supposed to be a rider sent ahead that said we needed six steamers.
No, we didn't get it.
Okay, this is something I need to take care of. Let me go find out about. Let me talk upstairs about the steamers and see if something was worked out.
Is this a real problem?
Yes, it is. That means about six more hours of work.
All right, let's see what happens.
The ballet bars, the white ones.
Yeah,
there.
We're going to store them somewhere up here.
We're not going to get the same truck back, right?
Right, because they're going to containers.
Okay.
I'm the road prop man. My name's Joe Giordano.
Things must go wrong sometimes, or do they more often go right?
More often right. The artistic director will come on stage after every piece and instruct them the things they've done right or done wrong, and that's every night, every piece, where American companies, you don't see that as much.
That's why it works so well.
Mm-hmm. And everything is so precise with them.
OTs, 6 meters.
Just one. Like 61. Stage right.
How are things going?
Better now.
You got your steamers?
I've got my steamers.
Sounds good. So everything's on track? You got
everything's on track.
And there are a lot of wrinkly costumes hanging around.
Yes, there are.
All of a sudden, the Firebird tree has been transformed from a chicken wire and green paper leaves to golden apples and leaves, and it's pretty magical looking.
For 6 weeks now, wherever we've been, I've turned around and things happen to bloom. It's come out, it's magic, it just shows up.
All of a sudden, you're in the magical kingdom of the Firebird.
Exactly.
It's okay.
Я не про это, я
the one that's hanging.
Я про зеленые кулисы, про зеленые.
Here it's leveled with a black light.
Yeah.
And over there.
Russia's famed Kirov Ballet is currently visiting Boston. For more on their worldwide tour, go to our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news in these stories, Here and Now.
We'll revisit the case of John Hinckley. Should the man who tried to kill President Reagan go free?
And we review the film and seafaring epic, Master and Commander.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.